Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. 2 years ago, I guess, was it 2 years ago, Craig, the big story was the manatee die-off? Yeah. Is that how long that was?
Yeah, that's when it started. And, you know, we had 1,000 manatees die, and then last year, another 800. So they've been in a world of hurt.
Yeah, tough times for manatees. We do have an episode on manatees in the archives. Yes. Where we really, that was pretty much at the peak of that tragedy, and you can go back and listen to that. But you in your most recent Florida Phoenix column, floridaphoenix.com, you've got an update on man-made attempts to help manatees, and this is the lettuce feeding, correct?
Yeah. They were really cautious about it because you don't want to feed wild animals and get them used to taking food from humans and then stop going after natural food. So they figured out a way to do it so that the manatees wouldn't necessarily associate it with humans. Mm-hmm. And they've been basically throwing romaine lettuce at the manatees for them to have something to eat. They've been doing it at Cape Canaveral because a lot of them gather there in the winter. And so they just finished the winter feeding for the second year, and it was a classic good news, bad news situation. The good news is fewer manatees are dying. The bad news is it's probably because we have fewer manatees because, you know, we lost 2,000 of them over the last couple of years.
And this is Florida Fish and Wildlife that is doing this?
Yeah, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because this is considered an unusual mortality event. And they're, you know, because... You know, we're used to hearing about manatees being run over by boats or getting caught in the locks of a canal or something like that. They're starving. They don't have anything to eat because algae blooms have killed off thousands and thousands of acres of seagrass beds, particularly in the Indian River Lagoon. Uh-huh. And so when they seek out warm water areas for the winter, and the Indian River Lagoon is a major one, they had nothing to eat. And so their choices were go somewhere that's cold and hope you can find something to eat before you freeze to death, or stay here and starve. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's how we lost it.
As terrible as the simple die-off is, when you understand what the reason or the cause, the manatees are starving. Mm-hmm. That is not a, you know, like short, painless death. That is a drawn out, agonizing, weakening, debility. Again, this is not, you died in a car accident, bam, you're alive 1 minute, dead the next. This is pain and suffering, and you're an animal, you know, you've been, you know, evolved through hundreds of thousands of years to survive and live in these places, and you have no idea why you can't find this once incredibly plentiful food source that is really their only food source. You know, this is not right. Like they're not like omnivores like bears. Well, yeah. If I don't have a mouse to eat, I can go eat berries, or I can go eat this, or I can go. They're like koalas. They eat this one thing.
That's why I was comparing it in the column to, you know, you walk into your favorite restaurant and the server says, "Hi, let me tell you about our specials tonight. There aren't any, and we also have no desserts and no side dishes and nothing to drink. And let me take your order, which is going to be an empty plate." That's basically what we've done to the manatees.
FloridaPhoenix.com. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Windstorm Products, windstormproducts.com. Want to remind you about those wonderful folks who've supported us for well over a year now. The number one online retailer of hurricane hardware, started off as a small Florida company on the Treasure Coast area and have grown into the world's largest online retailer of hurricane hardware. And that's like all the stuff you need to protect your house from hurricane wind damage. You know, the stuff to lock down the shutters and to secure the patio furniture and all this sort of thing. So we are not so far from hurricane season. And then last year, when you saw all the hurricanes go through the state and the damage at Sanibel and Captiva and everything, you're like, man, this is the year I'm going to do. I'm going to finally protect my house. And you haven't done it yet, have you? So now's the time. Windstormproducts.com. They've even got a number there. You know, they've been in this business for decades, and they can help connect you with contractors and the right people to know, well, do I need this? Do I not need that? Is that overkill? Is that too many? Hey, I've got this, I've got that. Tell them what your situation is, and they will hook you up with the right product so you're not totally having to do it yourself and not spending money on products that you don't need. Windstormproducts.com. Well, the manatee die-off and the seagrass bed die-off dovetails very nicely into this week's guest. Dan Egan is a New York Times best-selling author, a fellow Wisconsinite like myself. He joins us from the Milwaukee area, but his new book has a heavy Florida lean to it. It's The Devil's Element, Phosphorus and a World Out of Balance. What are we talking to Dan for today, Craig?
Well, we're talking to him for a couple of reasons. One is the way the book starts with a toxic blue-green algae bloom and its effect on one particular incident, which I'll let him tell us about that. But also he visits a couple of two or three other important places in Florida that have been affected by it. One is Bone Valley, where fertilizer is mined and is sold all over the country, and that's a major source of phosphorus. And then Lake Okeechobee, where a lot of fertilizer has been in the runoff that's gone into the lake and has spurred these toxic algae blooms that have then been released to the coasts of Florida, particularly the Stewart area, where they had just a horrible, horrible blue-green algae blooms. And it's happened over and over and over again. And so this seemed like a perfect topic for the podcast to tell people about that.
Absolutely. It is. I was excited when I saw this one pop up in the email invite from Craig. Phosphorus doesn't seem like the world's most fascinating topic, but believe me, its impact on manatee, on clean water in Florida, on Lake Okeechobee discharges, on our food system, agriculture.
On tourism.
There you go. You'll be surprised at how interesting phosphorus is in the hands of Dan Egan. Here we go.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us today, and congratulations on the new book. What first led you to be interested in this particular subject?
I worked at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for a couple of decades, and for most of that time, my beat was the Great Lakes, just kind of covering them from an environmental perspective. And after about 10 years, I took a break and I went out to Columbia University on a fellowship that turned into it was called a fellowship, but it was a master's program, and it required a book writing proposal class. And so I had to obviously put together a book proposal, and I looked at a lot of the work that I had done on the Great Lakes and saw that they stacked up like chapters, these big projects that I had done. And one of those projects was kind of a long look at the algae troubles of Lake Erie, and that was phosphorus driven. So while I was doing research for this Great Lakes book, I kind of went down a phosphorus rabbit hole. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, this is way more interesting than this book I'm working on about the Yeah, it just kind of grabbed me in a curious kind of way. And so once this Great Lakes book came out, and it did pretty well, I guess, well enough for the publisher to ask if I had any other ideas. And I said, phosphorus. Yeah. I sketched out a plan of attack for a book, and he said, all right, let's do it. So that's really how I first got interested in it. And specifically, I was in Toledo, Ohio, the week that city lost its drinking water supply, like a 500,000 people. And that was driven by toxic algae, which in turn was driven by phosphorus, which in turn was coming off of mostly agriculture fields.
Yeah. The Great Lakes book was a New York Times bestseller. The new book is just out, The Devil's Element, Phosphorus in a World Out of Balance. And phosphorus seems like this incredibly niche, it's almost like an academic. What is this guy, phosphorus? Right? I can imagine sitting in the seat of your publisher or editor or agent being like, do you have something anyone would read? But try and explain how pervasive phosphorus is in our modern world.
Well, and first, tell the remarkable anecdote that starts the book, which is set in Florida, is just incredible.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess I'll start with the anecdote that opens the book. I agree. Phosphorus is not the sexiest subject on the surface in the world, and because of that, I knew I had to come out hard. Opening the book with something pretty scintillating. And I actually took, I think, 3 trips to Florida while I was reporting this book. I probably would have taken more, but COVID got in the way. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting is after one of these trips, I got home and I have a Yahoo email account. So that compels me to log on to Yahoo in the mornings. And, you know, they have these silly stories. And one of them was about this guy who had been fleeing police in Cape Coral and jumped into this canal that was just smothered in this toxic, gooey, bright green algae. And fortunately, the cops were wearing body cameras, so you could watch this chase unfold. And I remember just coming back from Florida thinking, this is way more interesting than anything I saw over the last 4 or 5 days. So I really drilled down into it, and I got all the footage, and, you know, just decided that this would really make a good opening, because it's about a guy who jumps in the water trying to flee police, but he doesn't jump into water. He jumps into this toxic quagmire and basically starts to drown. And the police knew exactly what he had jumped into, and they're saying, hey, that stuff's dangerous, man. You know, we can't go in. They were calling for a life raft and for some lines. And the guy eventually dog paddled his way to the canal's edge, and he was hoisted or heaved ashore and started vomiting. And he was quickly taken to the hospital and then taken to the jail and charged with drug possession. Yeah. But I just thought that was an interesting little anecdote of how, you know, the real world collides with this often too esoteric world of environmental issues. And this wasn't an environmental issue. This was a human, you know, a human in peril issue. But it was driven by an environmental issue, which is driven by phosphorus.
Mm-hmm. And phosphorus is usage, which makes it omnipresent. You know, for folks listening, where is phosphorus? How prevalent is it in today's world?
It's everything. I mean, it's everywhere. It's in every living cell on the planet and perhaps the universe. You know, life could not exist without it. In humans, for example, it's a critical component of bones and teeth, but it's also in our DNA. Like literally, it is the sugar phosphates are the backbone of the swirling helix. That's our DNA is phosphorus. Just the way we burn energy, the process of ATP, that's phosphorus. So it's this critical, essential element that was, for very, very long, a very scarce commodity until the last couple hundred years ago, when humans figured out that it's also one of the three critical components to growing crops, the other two being nitrogen and potassium. And we don't really have a shortage issue of either of those, but phosphorus, we do have a shortage issue. At the same time, we're overdosing fields with it to the point where we're getting these toxic algae blooms, you know, from Florida to Washington State. So there's a real kind of paradox going on here that we're running out of it and we're blowing through it recklessly in a manner that doesn't always grow crops and too often grows toxic algae.
So phosphorus is a main component of fertilizer, correct? So when we're talking about the blue-green algae and the runoff, massive 100,000-acre fields covered with fertilizer, the phosphorus leaches off into the water supply.
Exactly. Yeah. And it leaches off in the form of commercial fertilizer and also in manure. Manure is rich with phosphorus. And so it makes for a great fertilizer, but it also, you know, accrues sometimes too fast for a farmer to really, you know, be able to have his pastures handle it. So it gets spread on fields, whether they need it or not.
I really like the section where you're talking about the dead zone in the Gulf also, where and sort of tying it in with ethanol. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than that. So the dead zone that everybody talks about in the Gulf of Mexico, that's out in salt water. And typically, salt water algae blooms are driven by nitrogen. That's the limiting factor, not phosphorus. But in 2019, things got a little crazy, and that's because it was the wettest 12 months on record in the Mississippi River Basin. So ungodly amount of water came tumbling down the Mississippi that summer, but it wasn't just water. It was nutrient-laden water, and it arrived on the Gulf Coast in such volumes that it basically drifted east once it hit the ocean, and it essentially turned the coast of Mississippi, the 40 miles of Gulf shore that Mississippi has, into fresh water. And that opened the door for these toxic algae blooms that nobody had seen on the Gulf Coast before. Nobody expected them. And, you know, these things aren't just like a aesthetic problem, or, you know, they're not just stinky and unsightly. They're poisonous. And so Mississippi Department of Environmental Quality people felt compelled to close the beaches starting at the end of June. And that closure remained in effect for the whole summer. And
wow.
Went down there. I don't know if you've been to Mississippi in the summer, but you want to swim. And the beaches, they're just these beautiful swaths of sand. They were just empty. And there was nobody there swimming, and there was nobody there renting all the jet skis that are available for rent. There was nobody buying ice cream, you know, nobody renting chairs and umbrellas. It was devastating. And, you know, I talked to a guy who rents jet skis down there at the time, and he felt like he was being regulated out of business. He was actually going to head to Georgia and sell his fleet of jet skis because he needed to make bank payments. But he said something that I thought was very succinct and relevant to what I was working on in terms of this book. He said, "Why am I being regulated out of business when the people causing this problem upstream aren't being adequately regulated?" And that was a good question. And that's one of the questions that this book explores.
Mm-hmm. Now, he says he's being regulated out of business. This was a human health and safety issue. This was not, he was not supposing that the beaches should be open and people allowed to swim in this water, was he? Or is that a philosophy?
Yes, you know, he was saying, I remember I think he was diabetic and he was in his 60s, and he said that he had been in the water and had shown no ill effects, but he did recognize that there were pockets along the Gulf Coast shoreline that only a fool would risk swimming in. And so the problem, the tricky stuff about this toxic algae is when it's bright and green and horrible looking, it's dangerous, but it can be even more dangerous when there's no sign of it, because the real danger from this stuff comes from the colorless, odorless toxins that it produces. And those can exist separate from these green splotches. Uh-huh. So out of an abundance of caution, they closed the whole shoreline. And there were a lot of people who had a problem with that. But, you know, you talk to somebody who's been sickened by this algae and they wouldn't have a problem with it. It's nasty stuff.
Yeah. Craig talks all the time about how in Florida, and it's the same case what you're talking about, the environment is the economy. Imagine Sarasota beaches or the Clearwater, St. Pete beaches or Panama City being closed 4th of July. Labor Day. Oh, I mean, that is, it's like the old line from Jaws, you know, you can pay me to catch this fish or you can all be on food stamps this, you know, winter. You know, that's when you make hay down there, and to have those beaches closed during the summer in a state like Mississippi that is not the most progressive, that is not a decision taken lightly. I mean,
No, it wasn't. And it actually, that's funny that you bring up Jaws, because that's exactly what I was thinking, because a lot of the Chamber of Commerce types were like, this is crazy, you know. There's no risk in this water. We've been swimming in it for years. Well, things are different now, and things were specifically different in 2019.
This actually reminds me, over in Stewart, they had a blue-green algae problem as a result of water being released from Lake Okeechobee, and they ended up having to close the beaches over the 4th of July weekend.
Oh yeah. I was in Stewart, can't remember which year, but I was at City Hall when there was, you know, a gathering of the outraged, and they were talking about, because the Army Corps had just announced that it was going to increase flows out of Lake Okeechobee down the St. Lucie and also down the Caloosahatchee River.
Yeah.
That headed toward Fort Myers. And, you know, they were doing it out of, the Army Corps was doing this out of concern that they didn't want the water to get too high in Lake Okeechobee, because if it does, then, you know, it threatens to tumble over the artificial banks or the levees holding the lake in place. And that's its own health hazard. But the solution was to send this gunk downstream. And the people who gathered at Stewart City Hall the day that I was there, you know, I thought it would have been like a bunch of environmentalists, but no, it was all, you know, political stripes were represented. All, you know, you had Rubio, had somebody there. It was a bunch of heavy hitters. And what really caught my attention was, you'd normally expect people showing up for something about, you know, concerned about the environment to be of a certain persuasion. But this wasn't, as you said earlier, it wasn't just about the environment. It's about the economy and it's about health. And there were a lot of pissed off people in that meeting that day.
Yeah. We hear about Lake Okeechobee water releases, and we've done, you know, a lot of episodes on this, and the St. Lucie and the Indian River Lagoon and the Caloosahatchee and all that. What is coming, and people probably have they think, well, there's water being released out of Lake Okeechobee. What's the big deal? It's more toxic waste, or at least as much toxic waste as it is water. You know, we think of water, it's water. Great. You know, so what? Yes, it is water. It is also heavily, heavily polluted and phosphorus, and the fertilizer and manure agricultural runoff is a big reason why it is so terribly polluted.
Yep. Yep. And then the jump from the fertilizer and the manure to the pollution really has to go through algae, because poop is gross enough. Manure is gross enough that the bacteria may have, but when it fuels this cyanobacteria, this blue-green algae, that takes it up a level. And yeah, some of these people at this meeting, I talked to one guy who said he hadn't eaten anything but Rolaids for 3 days. He ran some magazines out of, I think it was Stewart, or it was right next door. He had like a 6,000 square foot office on the canals, and he had to close it. They even shutting the windows and using the air conditioner, people were getting sick.
Because it gets airborne at some point, right? Or it's so heavy that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the human health effects that people should watch out for if they come in contact with this stuff?
In the acute state, it causes respiratory distress, but it's also a liver toxin. And there's an emerging concern that it's a neurotoxin that can, you know, cause neurodegenerative diseases over long-term exposure. So, yeah, I talked to a guy at that meeting in Stewart, a commercial fisherman, who had lost like 30 pounds, and the doctors couldn't figure it out. And he was convinced it was because he was spending so much time on the polluted water. And that week that I was there, they actually had, they posted the beaches is closed, and the local health network had issued some kind of statement saying anybody showing up, you know, with gastrointestinal illnesses, let's ask them if they've been in the water, and because that seems to be the common experience that so many people who were going into the emergency rooms had shown.
Wow. And open cuts wind up getting infected too, don't they? That's a problem.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's there. At least up here in the Great Lakes, a lot of times these algae blooms are also, they come along with a lot of rotting mussels, zebra mussels. So there's a lot of rotting protein, and that can open the door to a lot of bacteria and bad stuff. So yeah, it's really hard to think of it as a pollution because it just seems natural, but natural things can be dastardly as anything we can concoct in a lab too. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about where the fertilizer is coming from. Bone Valley.
Yeah. Yeah. I could have done a whole book on that. The mines, you know, east of Tampa. I went down and spent some time in Bone Valley. I was going to do so. So yeah, where we get phosphorus today, we used to just get it from natural sources. By that, I mean like manure, and even human waste was used as a fertilizer. Yeah. For the time.
I love the section on the bird guano islands, by the way. I thought that was terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. So we went from, you know, it's crazy. We went from just 10,000 years ago, agriculture started. And I think humans just intuited that, you know, land needed to be replenished because you couldn't just keep expecting things to sprout from it year after year without whatever it was in the soil being replenished. So they started doing that with manure and whatever they could find. And by the 1800s, you know, famine, because of the Little Ice Age, the crops weren't growing as they had historically. And Britain was really feeling squeezed. They started using bones, and they found that bones from knife factories, bones were typically used for knife handles. So the shavings and the waste piles, they found to be a miraculous fertilizer. So then they just
and the dead from Waterloo. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. So then they went from just the animal bones to human bones. And the British, you know, several years after the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, when 40,000 soldiers fell in like 10 hours and a bunch of horses, they went back and plundered that battleground for all the bones. But you know, they ran out of bones, and that's where they went to South America to harvest guano from the islands off of Peru, because birds nested on these islands and poop accreted over eons, and it never rains there, so it never washed back into the sea. And so that was our source of phosphorus. So we went from poop to bones to guano.
Yeah.
And eventually they found that certain rock deposits are rich with phosphorus. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on the perspective, Florida is, you know, kind of ground zero for the U.S. deposits. They're the primary deposits, and they come from Bone Valley. And some of them are, you know, some of the deposits are actually fossilized dead life. And most of them are sedimentary rocks that were once living, you know, comprised of once living material that have just, you know, compressed over the years and over the millions of years, and they turned into rock, but they still held all their phosphorus atoms, and that makes them a very effective fertilizer. But Bone Valley is playing out, you know, some estimates are, you know, 3 or 4 decades is all they've got. And then there's some other deposits in North Carolina and Idaho, but most of the deposits aren't in the U.S. 80% of them are in Morocco and Western Sahara. So we could be dependent on that region in the not too, too distant future for our fertilizer. It's really weird about, like, we're eating rocks, in a sense.
to tie a couple of ecological calamities together, and getting back to your bone thing, most people have probably at one point seen those pictures of the buffalo skulls, you know, in the giant pyramids. The mm-hmm. buffalo were exterminated for a lot of reasons to try and kill off the Native Americans, but also all those bones were then used for not all of them, but a lot of that bone matter was used as a fertilizer source. So, you know, there's a colonial project again run amok. We'll kill all the buffaloes to get the Indians off the plains and into reservations. And while we're at it, let's use all those bones for fertilizer.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's maybe they're apocryphal, but there's stories of out of Bone Valley where people were willing to shoot each other over roadbed gravel that had been spread before it was recognized as the nutritional trove that it is. And so, you know, there was a phosphorus rush in Florida. I think it was like in the 1850s or 60s probably, that rivaled what was going on in California a couple decades earlier with, you know, the gold rush of 1849, but it was a food rush, not a gold rush.
What do these mines look like? You know, most obviously they're not really visible from the road, and no one, you know, the miners, the mining companies don't want people to see them, but you've seen them. What does a phosphorus mine look like?
You know, I tried hard to get access to phosphorus mines, starting with North Carolina, and I had no luck. And, you know, it was so frustrating driving through Central Florida with, you know, you're like in these valleys because of the gypsum stacks, and you know there's stuff going on off the highway, you just don't know what. I can't tell you the nitty-gritties of what a phosphorus mine looks like, but you know, they're huge, and they don't have to dig that deep. The deposits, particularly in Florida, are really pretty close to the surface, and they're just grinding up rock and squeezing the phosphorus out of it and turning it into chemical fertilizer. Not the mines, the processing plants, but you know, you can look. I spent a fair amount of time looking at this one mine from space via satellite photos. This is a mine in Western Sahara, and it just looks like a massive scars on the landscape. But it doesn't happen. You know, it's not like they're going underground after coal. It's scraped from the surface.
What, for the folks who don't know, tell them what a gyp stack is, a phosphogypsum stack.
So that's the waste from the mining process. And, you know, a lot of it is just inert, but a lot of it is gypsum. But in Florida, I think you guys have issues with uranium and maybe cadmium, fluoride. There's a lot of bad stuff in it. And people have talked about using it in construction projects. But so far, perhaps wisely, I don't know the details of all that, but it hasn't been allowed to be used. So these piles stack up, and maybe you guys can enlighten me here. Somebody said that one pile is like the highest place in Florida, like this man-made mountain of mine waste. If it's not the highest, it's got to be pretty close because it's such a flat state.
Yeah, they're the mountains of Florida. Yeah.
Craig, you wrote it. Was it last summer that the one was almost going to fail, and they had evacuations, and a lot of it leached into the, was it Tampa Bay?
It was Piney Point. It was a few years ago. Yeah. But we're still dealing with the seagrass die off that resulted from dumping that waste in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, those waste piles are something to behold. And I thought, like I said, I could do a whole book on Florida's history with phosphorus mining.
Yeah.
But yeah, they are something to behold. And
if I'm not mistaken, and again, Craig, you would know better, is there not a bill in the legislature working its way through to allow Fiso gypsum to be used in roadbeds?
Yes. Yeah, I was actually going to mention that. There's a bill currently under consideration to allow them as a pilot project to allow the phosphate industry to use those big piles of radioactive waste in our roads. I guess so that, you could see to drive at night without lights.
Yeah. What could possibly go wrong, right? But yeah. You've got these mines, you've got these enormous stacks of waste. So obviously it's in the interest of the phosphorus companies to try and offload this somehow. And they probably want the state to buy it from them as another revenue stream.
Well, and the EPA used to forbid using it in any way at all. And that's why they had to stack it up. But during the Trump administration, the EPA changed their mind with very little notice to anybody and said it would be okay.
So what's it being used for now?
Right now, it's not being used for anything.
Okay. Just, but that's the door to potentially using it for roadbed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Piney Point situation, these stacks get so large, there was the worry was that it was going to like give way and create like a giant avalanche, essentially, of Fiso gypsum, right? So they had to sort of...
On the top of them, you can't see it from the roads, but on the top of them are ponds. And because so vast, the water accumulates up there, and then, it's going to seep into the pile. It can potentially seep into the pile, and then, that could cause the pile to slough. And then all that toxic water. And that's, I think that's what happened. That's what you were talking about.
Right? Yeah.
On the other hand, fertilizer and the world's exploding population over the past, 50, 20 years, especially, can the world produce enough food without supercharging agriculture with fertilizer to sustain the population?
Yeah, that's the tension. That's really what this whole issue is all about. And I guess I would make the argument that, in 1900, just when Florida's fertilizer industry was starting to take off, there were maybe a billion people on the planet. Well, yeah, today there's 8 billion and we're on our way to 9 billion. And as developing countries develop, they're probably going to demand or want more meat-based diets, which is even going to require more fertilizer inputs. So it seems like we're kind of on a collision course. Even if the stuff wasn't, finite, we would be in danger of, getting to the point where we're polluting our water. But we're doing both. We're running out of it and we're polluting our water. And how can we move forward in a way that we have food and fresh water? I mean, that's really the only road we as humanity can take. And that's going to require rethinking how we manage agriculture and specifically agricultural waste. And I'm talking about manure primarily. It's too often just looked at as something that needs to be disposed of. And that's how it ends up on fields, whether those fields need the nutritional boost or not. The English, we were talking earlier about how fertilizer starved they were. If they could see one of these modern sewage or manure lagoons, they wouldn't see it as a big pit of yuck. They'd see it as like a big pit of yum because it's food. It's the pathway toward food. And we need to get back to that point where we recognize that phosphorus isn't meant to be used once and flushed off the landscape and into our water. But as best we can, it needs to be recycled. And, it's the circle of life, literally. When you think about the classic bucolic farm with pastures and cows grazing it and pooping on it, and their poop is, providing more grass, and that's more food for the cow, and that's more poop for the grass, and on and on and on it goes.
Yeah.
It's the circle of life, but we've cracked it and turned it into a straight line that runs from farm field to water. And that's where we got to start rethinking how we're doing.
Sure. Things. Yeah. There's a regenerative way of agriculture, and then there is an industrial way, and that's the way we use it now. And, obviously, when we had our episode on ranching, Craig, I talked about how, well, there used to be, 100 million buffalo on the plain. And, the methane and the poop they were producing was a positive benefit. No one was looking, this is, carbon emitting, and this was contributing to greenhouse gases and climate warming. No, their manure was essential to regenerating the grasses and the, like you say, the circle of life. So how would modern agriculture reincorporate the manure and the phosphorus and the fertilizer in a productive way, as opposed to just shooting it into the nearest river and bringing more in?
Well, it would take treatment. And so, you know, when we got the Clean Water Act in 1972, they largely left agriculture alone because they thought that the pollution was too diffuse, not significant enough, and also too hard to regulate, to treat. But things have changed in the last 50 years, and these farms have gotten so big that they are, by definition, you know, the Clean Water Act makes this distinction between point source polluters, which are basically people with pipes and smokestacks and sewage treatment plants, and non-point, which is landscape pollution. Well, with these sewage or manure lagoons now, that is, you know, arguably, by definition, a point source of pollution. And it would require treating it. And one of the problems right now is farmers, the rule of thumb, they'll say, like, if they have to ship manure more than 10 miles from where it's produced, from their barns, then it becomes a money loser right off the bat. And it's just going to be unaffordable. Well, you know, there's a price we're paying for allowing this stuff just to wash off the landscape untreated, and that's in toxic waters. And, you know, we all need food, but we also need water. And so I think where we would go with this, where people should start exploring, is processing, treating these manure lagoons, you know, just like we treat human waste. And it will cost money. But like I said, we're already paying a price that's not in the ledgers, in the form of poisoned waters. So also, once you start treating it, you can concentrate the phosphorus and other nutrients in that manure, you know, down to make it just as pure as anything that's coming from a modern chemical fertilizer factory. And it's a lot easier to move around a dump truck full of pellets than, you know, 18-wheelers sloshing with manure. Yeah. It's a lot more efficient. So there's opportunities. And it's been estimated that if we did, you know, take full advantage of the nutritional properties of manure, we could account for about 50% of the chemical fertilizer being produced today. So it would buy us time from the supply that we're running out. It will also protect water. So it's a win-win.
Well, and that really, you have tremendously, enlightened me and sort of filled in some puzzle pieces, because you think about, well, why is it so hard to regulate these farms and all of the waste running off of them? And you talk about, well, they didn't initially apply or qualify under the Clean Water Act, because when that was signed 50 years ago, farms weren't as large as they are today, with tens of thousands of cattle crammed on them, you know, the huge industrial livestock production. So they have a loophole, essentially, their pollution.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I don't want to disparage the agriculture industry. They're just operating under the rules that were handed down to them. I mean, obviously, I'm sure they had some role in influencing them, but still, they're operating within the system that we've sanctioned. And I think the problems with the system, it's not with individual, you know, farmers being greedy. It's just, this is the way they operate, and it's worked for a long time, but it's not working so well anymore. And I would just add, in one of my trips to Florida, I spent some time with a rancher in the Lake Okeechobee watershed, and it was really interesting. The ranchers are, you know, if they're not in phosphorus balance, they're close to it, because they send a lot of phosphorus out of the watershed in the form of calves, and you know, they produce a lot, but what they're producing is being applied to the fields, and it's growing their grass. So they aren't the black-hatted operators that some people might assume they are at all. But dairies are a different story. You know, they're staying in one place and creating a lot of pollution, and often in places that don't have enough land to absorb with that pollution.
And that guy who was renting jet skis on the Gulf of Mexico in Mississippi, That's what he's talking about. Why isn't the source end of this regulate? You know, I'm incurring all of the costs here on my end. My business is going down the tubes. While there are some, you know, dairy farmer in Iowa with 50,000 head of cattle, and he's producing tons of manure every single day that's going into the Gulf, that's going into the Mississippi. It's winding up in the Gulf of Mexico, and that's closing my beach.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't look at this book as like some great call to action. It's more connecting the dots that you're just talking about.
Yeah. Well, you picture a really good comment, I think, in your section about Lake Okeechobee, where you said there's a plan to reduce the inputs of the fertilizer that's going into the Lake Okeechobee. It's just a plan. There's no enforcement for it.
Yeah. Some of the people I talked to down there were very distressed about the lack of enforcement of even the relatively weak rules that are on the books. And yeah, you know, when we had pollution troubles in the 60s and 70s and we got the Clean Water Act, that came with, you know, some pretty big sticks, not just carrots. And right now we're trying to manage this with carrots, and it's manifestly not working, or you wouldn't have people having to move out of their office buildings in Stuart, Florida.
Yeah. Well, you have obviously a broader perspective on this. Your book about the Great Lakes, obviously, livestock, dairy, farming, you know, that's a huge industry up there. This affects the Mississippi River, the Gulf of Mexico, Florida, you talk a lot about. Is anyone doing this right? I mean, governmentally, municipally, at a state level? Not that Florida is going to take anyone's advice on anything, but, you know, is there a model for, hey, we've got a phosphorus problem, we've got a clean water problem, we've got an algae bloom problem. Have you seen a model of, hey, there's someone who's really handling this appropriately?
Okay, so in Wisconsin, where I am, they have some pretty strict phosphorus, state phosphorus regulations. But because of this clean water exemption, it's largely an exemption for agriculture, their hands are tied. So up in Green Bay, my home city, they created it's called total maximum daily load. It's basically a phosphorus diet for the Bay of Green Bay. And this is in the heart of America's dairy land. And so there's this prescription that's been written, and it's forcing like industries and sewage treatment plants, particularly the sewage treatment plant in Green Bay, was, you know, given this edict that it had to reduce its phosphorus discharges by X number of pounds. I can't remember what it was, but the argument was, you know, this is going to cost $200 or $300 million, and it's going to have no appreciable impact on the Bay because we're such a relatively small contributor. So the state's gotten flexible here, and it's kind of like carbon cap and trade. They're having manure trades or phosphorus trades. So they're allowing the district to take money and move upstream and work with farmers on, I hate to say, best management practices, but yeah, just farming with buffers and cover crops, things that can absorb the phosphorus and keep it from getting in the water in the first place. So like the toilet flushers in Green Bay are paying for the dairyman's mess, but under the current regulatory system, that may not make sense just intuitively, but under the current regulatory system, it's the only direction they can really go. Otherwise, they're going to end up spending millions and millions of dollars reducing just a trickle of phosphorus from the wastewater treatment plants, when, you know, they could probably take that money and just pay farmers not to farm. But see, then again, that's tricky because obviously we need agriculture.
Right. But, yeah, it's a tough choice.
It is. I don't think it's. I don't think that's the choice. I don't think it's food or clean water. We can have both. We've just got to start thinking about how they're related.
Good point. Yeah. Good point. Dan Egan is the author of The Devil's Element, Phosphorus and a World Out of Balance. Thank you so much for joining us. I found this incredibly personally enlightening, you know, connecting these dots. And, you know, phosphorus is, you know, we'll have to push hard to get people to listen to the podcast, because, again, what in the world? But the effect this has, clean water, agriculture, the food system, man, it is an incredibly pervasive element. And thank you so much for bringing your knowledge to us today.
Thanks. I appreciate that. And I would just say real quickly, it sounds boring, but, you know, I spent 3 years with it and I get bored reading easily. And this isn't boring.
No,
No, it's a fascinating book. There's lots of different things, and we haven't even talked about how you were persuaded not to try to make phosphorus from your own urine. So,
thanks, Dan. Have a good day.
Thanks you.
All right, we'll see you. Yeah, Craig, this is one of those weird topics where, you know, like when we did you had a column on glyphosate that, you know, is just a topic that is so niche, but personally, incredibly interesting to me. This is another one. We don't recognize the role this plays in our world and how, you know, everyone wants to talk about manatee deaths, right? I mean, that's a very catchy, and you know, that's kind of how we started the episode today. Well, where do you think that die-off comes from?
Yeah,
they're not dying from cancer.
You know? No, it's the algae blooms that shade out the seagrass that they eat. So they're the canaries in the coal mine. Really big canaries, but they're the canaries.
Well, and I just listening to Dan talk, you know, if this is a topic that interests you, we did an episode on red tide that's still one of our most listened to. We've done Lake Okeechobee episodes, a number of them. The episode on the Gulf, one of my favorite. Tarpon fishing, one of my favorites. We did a couple episodes on freshwater springs. We did the episode on ranching in Florida. All of those circle around this topic of phosphorus. I remember talking about the Piney Point and the physogypsum stack. Mm-hmm. And last week I was reading a story about the legislature wanting to put physogypsum in roads. This is a topic by no means that is going away. And I think we're probably only scratching the surface of how we're going in this state, going to collide with the negative effects of phosphorus.
I just keep thinking back to the woman I talked to in Stewart when the blue green algae bloom there was so bad, people were comparing it to guacamole. That's how thick it was, and she said it smelled like death on a cracker. I just, you know, and that's our future unless we get a hold of this and somehow work out a way to stop it.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.